This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Tom Waits is one of the true eccentrics of pop music. There's always been an element of mystery surrounding his life. The people he sings about usually are outsiders, outlaws, drunks, hobos, and losers.
He had three old dogs, one out car, the wife who was leaving for good. Life's made of trouble, worry, pain, and struggle. She wrote goodbye in the dust on the hood. We found a map of Missouri, lipstick on the glass. They must have left in the middle of the night.
That's How's It Gonna End, from the new Tom Waits recording, Real Gone. The darkness of his lyrics is enhanced by the rumble and rasp of his voice, a voice that sounded old even when he was young. Waits has been recording since 1973. His songs have been used on the soundtracks of several films, and he's acted in the movies Down by Law, Shortcuts, Wolfen, Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, and Coffee and Cigarettes. Terry spoke with Tom Waits in 2002.
The arrangements for your songs are really good. Do you do the arrangements yourself?
Well, I collaborate with my wife on the songs and every aspect of it, really, from composing and arranging and recording, all that business. So, you know, we have a rhythm and a way of working it. It's kind of like borrowing the same $10 from somebody over and over again. But, you know, when you live together, you know, it makes it a lot easier, the payback, you know.
What came first to you, for you, being married or being song collaborators?
I don't know. It seemed like, you know, we started working together right after we got married, I think. And my wife had $50 on her, and I had $20. We got married, and it was a $70 wedding, so I actually thought this is not a good way to start. But we got married about 1 o'clock in the morning out in Watts, and it was kind of a whirlwind thing, and the preacher was on a beeper. It worked out. You know, sometimes I had, you know, really expensive weddings only last a couple of weeks. It worked, yeah.
So you weren't already writing songs when you got together?
Oh, well, I was, yeah.
No, the two of you, collaborating.
No, not really. No, we only know each other a short time when we got married. No, we didn't really have any time to write any songs. We just kind of swooped down and then we did it.
It worked, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it did, yeah.
You got a wife and a songwriting partner.
Yeah, right.
It's a good deal.
Yeah, it was a good deal, yeah. And, you know, when you collaborate, sometimes it's somewhat of a quarrel, but I think that it is good. I think it keeps you away from the emperor's new clothes or whatever. Someone to check into with that you trust, you know. It's been really good for both of us.
Did you think it's changed your style of songwriting, either changed the music itself or changed the process of writing the music to collaborate?
Well, I don't know. I can run things by her, and she said, "Well, that's a lot of hogwash. You've been doing that for years," or you know.
that's really corny, or that's really cliche, or it's good. Yeah. So we kind of sharpen each other like knives, and it seems to work out like that.
Some of your music writing seems influenced by the German songs of Kurt Weill. Have you listened a lot to him? Do you feel like he's influenced your writing?
Well, you know, I hadn't really listened to him until I had people tell me that I sounded somewhat like him or had some influence in there. So I said, well, I better start listening to this stuff. And
what'd you think?
I liked it. It's really, a lot of it's really angry. And I guess I like beautiful melodies telling me terrible things.
And, well put, yeah.
So it works for me. Yeah.
What was the music that you grew up listening to because your parents were listening to it? I mean, before you were old enough to choose music yourself, what was the music in your house?
Really young mariachi music, I guess. My dad only played a Mexican radio station, and then Frank Sinatra, and later Harry Belafonte, and then I would go over to my friends' houses, and I would go into the den with their dads and find out what they were listening to. That's what I was really. I couldn't wait to be an old man. I was about 13, I didn't really identify with the music of my own generation, but I was very curious about the music of others. And I think I responded to the song forms themselves, cakewalks and waltzes and barcarolles and parlor songs and all that stuff. I think which are just really nothing more than jello molds for music. But I seem to like the old stuff, Cole Porter and Oscars and Hammerstein and Gershwin and all that stuff. I like melody.
So when you were 13, being more interested in the music of your parents, your friends' parents, than in your friends' music, what was the music of your generation that didn't interest you?
Like the Strawberry Alarm Clock, or but later I like that stuff. Like the Animals and Blue Cheer and Led Zeppelin and all that stuff, and the Yardbirds, and of course Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Bob Dylan, and James Brown. I was really, really hot on James Brown.
What did you hear in them later that you didn't hear when you were in your early teens?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I felt like it was safe to go in and listen to it now that it had been there for a while or something. I don't know. I think when you're a teenager, that music is really kind of like a collared shirt or a watch. It seems more of an accessory, a certain level.
Or a badge of identity.
Yeah, you're making a remark about yourself as to what you listen to, and I think that part bugged me, and so it kind of kept me from really listening to it just as music.
Now, you said your father listened mostly to the Mexican station and to mariachi music.
Yeah.
Was your father Mexican?
No, my dad's from Texas. He grew up in a place called Sulphur Springs, Texas, and my mom's from Oregon. She listened to church music. All that Brother Springer, she used to send money into all the preachers, but the early songs I remember was Abilene. When I heard Abilene on the radio, it really moved me. And then I heard, Abilene, prettiest town I've ever seen. Women there don't treat you mean. And Abilene, I just thought that was the greatest lyric. Women there don't treat you mean. And then, Detroit City. Last night I went to sleep in Detroit City. And I dreamed about the cotton fields back home. I liked songs with the names of towns in them, and I think I liked songs with weather in them. and something to eat. So I feel like there's a certain anatomical aspect to a song that I respond to. I think, oh, yeah, I can go into that world. There's something to eat. There's the name of a street. There's a, okay, yeah, there's a saloon. Okay. So I think probably, yeah, that's why I put things like that in my songs.
You know how you said when you're in your early teens, music is almost like a certain type of collar or a certain type of accessory. When you started listening to older music and relating to that, did other things accompany that, like a certain way of dressing or speaking or behaving?
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, I wore an old hat and I drove an old car. I bought a car for $50 from Fred Moody next door, who's from Tennessee. 55 Buick Special, and, you know, AM radio in there. I guess, yeah, sure. You know, I walked with a cane. You know, I was really, I was going overboard, perhaps. But
What kind of cane is it?
You know, a cane.
Like, no, I mean, was it, did it have like a silver tip? I mean, how?
No, an old man's cane from a Salvation Army.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I carved my name in it and everything.
And what did you think that added to your image?
It gave me a walk, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Gave me something distinctive. Oh, what was that guy in here earlier with a cane? Did you see that guy? It just gave me something that I liked, identity-wise, I guess.
I want to play another track from Blood Money. And this is called A Good Man Is Hard to Find. This is Tom
sure.
Waits.
Russian roulette in my head, 17 black, 429 red. How far from the gutter, how far from the pew, I will always remember to forget about you. Good man is hard to find. Won't let strangers keep in my field. In my field, words are goodbye. In my favorite child.
I want to ask you about your voice. You have a very raspy singing voice. Was that a sound that you strove for, you know, that you worked on having, or is it what naturally developed?
It's that old man thing. I come right to be an old man. Old man with a deep voice. No, yeah, I scream into a pillow.
Well, you know John Mahoney, the actor?
Sure, yeah.
He told me he actually did stuff like that, wanted a distinctive voice. And and so he used to do these exercises that he practiced in a closet of just, like, shouting and trying to, you know, like, growl a lot. And
yeah.
He actually permanently did something to his vocal cords as a result of it.
Yeah, hooray. I'm all for it.
was say, Louis Armstrong an influence on you?
Oh, God, yeah, sure. Yeah. You know. You can't ignore the influence of someone like Louis Armstrong. It's you know, he's like a river. He's like a country to be explored in and of himself. And but yeah, he was like he came out of the ground just like a potato. You know, he's completely natural. Yeah, sure, love those tunes and. But this one, this Good Man's Hard to Find was, yeah, it was an attempt to kind of tip my hat somewhat to that.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you ever worried about hurting your voice by?
Oh, I've heard it. Yeah, I have heard it. But I have a voice doctor in New York who used to treat Frank Sinatra and various people. He said, "Oh, you're doing fine. Don't worry about it."
That's good. Now, you once said that you wish you could have been a part of the Brill Building era in which people like Carole King and Lee Bernstoller and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry were writing songs for singers and for vocal groups. What do you think you would have liked about that?
Well, I guess writing at gunpoint sounds really exciting to me. Those kinds of deadlines. I went to a rehearsal building on Times Square in New York one afternoon, and a really tiny little room. In fact, it was probably smaller than the room I'm in right now, which is a little larger than a phone booth. There's just enough room for a little spinet piano, and then you could just barely close the door, and there you were. And it was, and you could hear every kind of music coming to you through the walls and through the windows and underneath the door. And you heard African bands, and you heard, like, comedians, and you'd hear applause every now and then, and you'd hear tap dancers, and I think I just liked the whole melange of it, how it all kind of mixes together. Mm-hmm. I like turning on two radios at the same time and listen to them. I like hearing things incorrectly. I think that's how I get a lot of ideas, is by mishearing something.
Although you weren't part of the Brill Building thing, other people have recorded your songs, and I thought I'd play one of them. Johnny Cash recorded your song "Down There by the Train."
Yeah, right. That killed me. That was wild. I said, "That's it. I'm all done now." Boy, Johnny Cash did a song of my boy. I'm all done. Thanks very much. was really flattering. I loved the way he did it, too.
Oh, yeah. Do you know how he knew the song or why he decided to record it?
Well, a lot of people sent him tunes because he's doing this record with Rick Rubin and different people that different songwriters sent him tunes, and then he just picked from them. So I didn't know if he was going to do it or not. I figured, well, I hadn't done it. I don't know why I hadn't done it. I don't remember who. So I didn't really know until I heard the record came out. It was like, wow, that's great. When someone does a tune, especially someone that you've been listening to since you're a kid, it's a bit of a validation. It's meaningful.
Yeah, Johnny Cash is pretty validating when it comes to that.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is from Johnny Cash's American Recordings album, and this is the Tom Waits song, "Down There by the Train."
You can hear the whistle, you can hear the bell, from the halls of heaven to the gates of hell, and there's room for the forsaken if you're there on time. You'll be washed of all your sins and all of your crimes if you're down there by the train. 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 Down there where the train goes slow.
That's Johnny Cash doing the Tom Waits song, "Down There by the Train." My guest is Tom Waits. Did you hear anything different in that song when Johnny Cash recorded it, different from how you heard it in your head when you wrote it?
Well, he changed some stuff around. That's normal. I do the same thing when I do somebody else's tune. You try it on, and if it's a little tighter in here, or doesn't quite close over this, you cut it or you make it fit. You want to make it sound like yours.
It's funny because that song, when he sings it, it sounds like it's like an unusual spiritual.
Oh, yeah.
And usually you write about godlessness.
Godlessness? Really? Oh.
Wouldn't you say?
I don't know about that.
The absence of God?
I don't know. Do you think so?
Well, some of the songs. Yeah. Well, one of them explicitly, like, "God's away on business."
Oh, okay. Well, he's away. He's not gone. He's just away. And you have to understand, he was on business. So, you know, and a guy like him has got to be busy, and he's looking after a lot of things, you know.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. We've been listening to a 2002 interview with Tom Waits. Now let's hear a little of Terry's 1988 conversation with him. He'd just made the performance film Big Time, in which he appeared as several different characters. Terry asked him about one of them, Vegas lounge singer Buddy Greco.
Well, you know, I should play a couple of Vegas homages that you do here. I mean, this is, I think of this as your homage to Frank Sinatra and to showbiz anthems.
A lot of people think that is Frank Sinatra.
Oh, singing on it, really?
Yeah, Straight to the Top. A friend of mine was in the car with his mom and put on the tape, and she went, gee, is that a new Frank Sinatra song? And she was dead serious.
Well, you know, I really like the song. I mean, it seems to me that it's more of an homage than a parody. Do you know what I mean? I think it's a good song.
Oh, why, thank you.
You do think of that way, too? I mean, I don't read it as a parody as much as... tell me what you think.
Tell you what I think about what?
About your song, Straight to the Top.
Well, that's one of those one of those phrases that just keeps you going.
Okay.
It's like Big Time. You know, it's like you got to have a plan in this world. You know, you got to have some place you want to go so you know when you've arrived. And Straight to the Top is just one of those songs.
I've put together a little medley of Straight to the Top and I'll Take New York so we can hear a little bit of both of them.
Boy, thank you.
Hey. Somebody's got to put showbiz medleys together, right?
Yeah.
So let's give it a listen. And this is this is in the movie Big Time, but we're going to play it from the album Frank's Wild Years. And this is Tom Waits.
I'm going straight to the top. Whoa. I'm going where the air is fresh and clean. I'm going straight up to the top. If you know me, you know what I mean. I can't let Mr. Sorrow try and pull old Frankie down. We'll live for tomorrow. I found you straight to the top. I'm going up where the air is fresh and clean. I know I'm never gonna stop. I know I'm wild and free. Hey,
I'm Tipper Newsboy.
That's Tom Waits. I have to say, when you do this in the movie, there's something very Liza about it, very Liza Minnelli, like in New York, New York.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
You know, with your arm gestures, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I get a lot of that type of thing. People think that we're not going out anymore, but she gave me a lot.
Well, here's my fantasy about your voice, that you initially sang hoarse because you liked it stylistically, and then you ended up with a really hoarse voice.
You mean like if you cross your eyes, they'll stay that way? when your mom says, don't turn your eyelids inside out, Bobby.
I guess not unlike that, yes. So that's my fantasy. What's the reality?
I don't know. I guess when I was a little kid, I used to try to make my voice lower. Because I wanted to grow up real fast so I could be an old man and play golf. You know, I couldn't wait to get there, wear wild slacks and drink coffee and smoke cigars and talk about finance. And it happened very, very fast. You know, when I started talking like this, you know, there I saw the clubs. They appeared in the corner of the room. And so, I don't know. I guess you get the voice you deserve.
Are you taking better care of your voice now? I read that you'd given up smoking.
Uh-huh.
And that's really hard to do. So you
it
must have really been
to
committed to doing it.
I am committed to doing it. I drink my own urine, and I think that's...
that's enough for your voice, right?
it's not bad with a little ice and a twist.
This is the doctor's recommendation, no doubt.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can, you know, I still have a falsetto. it's somewhere around here.
You want to demonstrate that for us?
Well, that's going to cost you.
Right, okay. I want to give our listeners a sense of what you were doing earlier in your career and the kinds of... stories and songs that you would do based on what you'd seen in diners and in bars. This is from an early album of yours called Nighthawks at the Diner.
Mm. I was always kind of one who liked to consider myself kind of a pioneer of the palate. Restaurateur, if you will. I've wined, dined, sipped, and supped in some of the most demonstrably Beamer epitomable bistros in the Los Angeles metropolitan region. Yeah, I've had strange looking patty melts at Norm's. I've had dangerous field cutlets at the Copper Penny. Well, what you get is a breaded Salisbury steak and a shake and bake and topped with a provocative sauce of Velveeta and half and half. Smothered with Campbell's tomato soup. See, I had kind of a, I ordered my veal cutlet, Christ, it left the plate and it walked down the end of the counter. Waitress name I read, boy, she wearing those rhinestone glasses with a little pearl thing clip on a sweater. My veal cutlet come down, try to beat the shit out of my cup of coffee, but coffee just wasn't strong enough to defend itself.
What are some of the things that scared you as a kid, either that scared you in real life or movies or music that you found frightening? Interesting but frightening.
Oh, I don't know. I guess like the plastic covers on sofas always scares me. The sound that makes when you sit down on a sofa that's covered with plastic kind of crinkles and... I don't know. I used to watch Alfred Hitchcock and The Twilight Zone. Those captivated me. Those little tales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Monster movies.
And monster movies, yeah, sure. But you know, things that really scared me, I don't know. I guess, you know, I could conjure up just about anything and scare myself, you know. If I heard a sound at night, you know, and then it would get larger and larger and stranger and stranger, and I would get, you know, afraid to get out of bed. And I think I had some kind of a disorder, you know, the way I heard things. If I moved my hand across in the air, I heard like,
Wow, really?
And cars going by sounded like planes. And yeah, very small sounds in the house got enormous. But I think it was just a temporary condition.
Did you ever see a doctor about it?
They said they couldn't help me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What was your first instrument?
I don't know. I don't know. Probably a box or something.
But, I mean, the first instrument.
Oh, my dad gave me a guitar when I was about 9, and, you know, I learned El Paso, and, actually, I learned it in Spanish, because he wouldn't purchase any, you know, like, English-speaking records. He didn't like them. And in fact, I remember going
by... This was your father, yeah.
It's my dad, yeah. We went by a stop sign once. There was a guy in a hot rod with, you know, with a duck tail and everything, greased down here, combed way back. And he's gunning the motor, and we're in the station wagon, and he looked over at that guy, like, you know. And then he looked over at me, and then, as if to say, don't get any ideas, you know. So I had a guitar. I learned 3 chords. I thought I knew everything, and it kind of grew from there.
Now, you dropped out of high school. Why did you drop out? Is there something that you want to do instead, or did you just hate going?
Oh, I wanted to go into the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, enough of this.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like the ceiling in the rooms. I didn't like the holes in the ceiling, the little tiny holes and the cork board and the long stick used for opening the windows.
Oh, God, yeah, we had one of those in my elementary school,
I just hated all that stuff. I was real sensitive to my visual surroundings, and I just wanted to get out of there.
Did any adults try to stop you, either your parents or teachers?
I had good teachers. I had some... my folks broke up when I was about 11, So I had teachers that I liked a lot. I kind of looked up to, but then they seemed like they couldn't wait to get out into the world themselves and do some, you know, banging around and learning and growing. So I thought maybe they were encouraging me to leave.
So did you succeed in kind of getting out into the world, so to speak?
Pretty much, yeah.
What'd you do?
Oh, yeah, I hitchhiked all over the place, I don't know.
What's the craziest ride that you got when you were hitchhiking that you would shudder to think about now?
I had some good things that happened to me hitchhiking, because I did wind up on New Year's Eve in front of a Pentecostal church, and an old woman named Mrs. Anderson came out to the... I was stuck in a town with like 7 people in this town, and trying to get out, you know. And my buddy and I were out there for hours and hours and hours, getting colder and colder. And it was getting darker and darker. And finally, she came over. She says, "Come on into the church here. It's warm and there's music, and you can sit in the back row." And we did. And they were singing, and they had a tambourine, electric guitar, and a drummer. And they were, you know, talking in tongues, and then they kept gesturing to me and my friend, Sam. I said, "These are our wayfaring strangers here." And so we felt kind of important. And they took up a collection. They gave us some money, bought us a hotel room and a meal. And we got out the next morning, and we hit the first ride, 7 in the morning, and we were gone. It was really nice. I still... remember all that, and gave me a good feeling about traveling.
Uh-huh. Did you ever do the street musician thing?
I didn't, but when I see people do it, I see, oh, man, I should have done that. That's how you really get your chops together, you know. Because I'm real, I guess, particular about, how, you know, those things. I get real nervous. But I think I wish I had done that, because it looks like a... takes a lot of guts, and I think that you'd probably cut through a lot of potential stage fright that you would eventually have, and maybe help you down the road.
So has stage fright been an issue for you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I go through all kinds of stuff about it. But, you know, when I get out there, I'm all right.
So the bad part is thinking about going out.
Yeah. And but my first gigs, my first big gigs, are opening show for Frank Zappa, and I think that was difficult. I was kind of like the rectal thermometer for the audience, and it was a little awkward for me. I was alone, and I was performing in front of large groups of people, and they were verbally abusive, and I think it. I'm like a dog. I was beat as a dog. So,
is there a point in your career that you see as a turning point from getting to where you are now from where you were when you started performing?
Oh yeah, probably. Well, I got married. Really, you know, that was it. You know, I mean, that's like the most important thing I ever did. And then Kathleen really was the one that encouraged me to produce my own records. You know. And,
mm-hmm. What kind of music background is she from?
Oh, gee, I don't know. Oh, she's got, like, opera in there, and she was going to be a nun, you know, so we changed all that.
Yeah, I guess so.
But you know, she's adventurous, you know, and she kind of picks up a lot of stations that I don't pick up. I get kind of narrow and concerned in making something, give it four legs and getting it to stand up. And she's more interested in what goes inside, and which is very feminine. And I think that's what works. And the idea of going into the studio and doing your own record is kind of scary. You know, pick the engineer, pick all the musicians, and you know, write some kind of mission statement for yourself and what you want it to be and sound like and feel like, and take responsibility for everything that goes on the tape. That's a lot to do, especially it's a lot for a record company to let you do when you behave like I did. And they thought I was, I think they thought I was a drunk, and they, you know, and I was really non-communicative, and I scratched the back of my neck a lot, and I looked down at my shoes a lot, and I you know, and I wore old suits, and they were nervous about me. It's understandable. And in those days, they didn't really let artists produce themselves. That was also the day of the producer, you know, the big shining producer who was like, I guess like the director on a film. They give you the money and they say, go make a record with this guy over here. See what you can get out of him. But once I got a taste for it, I really, really liked it.
Tom Waits, thank you so much. It's really been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Oh, we're all done.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nice to talk to you, Terry.
Tom Waits speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. His new CD is called Real Gone. Here's another track from it called Dead and Lovely.
She was a middle class girl. She was in over her head. She thought she could stand up in the deep end. He had a bulletproof smile. He had money to burn. She thought she had the moon in her pocket. But now she's dead. She's so dead.